find myself for 3 years losing a couple $100,000. You know, I was looking at where I was and seeing a lot of the money that I'd made early on in my career start to slip away. And then you start to make decisions and wonder, you know, do I need to cut back with what I'm spending? But then you're running the risk of not being as professional because you don't have that sort of daily commitment of people who are on you. And that's when a lot of the self-doubt starts to come and creep in because you don't really know where you're at or where you can be and what the future holds.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It's this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel tennis podcast, Beyond the Baseline. Today's guest, Ryan Harrison, fresh from winning his first ATP title that came in Memphis over the weekend. He now is a career high ranking number 43, and if you look at his points to defend, there ain't much. So that number threatens to get ever higher. Ryan talks a bit about his career. Of course, broke through as a teenager, had a couple of rough years in the middle, and now in his mid-20s seems to have found traction again. Always one of the more analytical players, good guy to talk to. We talk a bit about the rise and fall and rise of his career. We talk about his relationship with his father, some of the emotional outbursts that he, like so many players, endure on the court, no matter how different that is from their off-court personality. Good wide-ranging conversation. Always good to talk shop with Ryan Harrison. Of course, we're catching him at the high point of his career. So let's bring him in from Austin, Texas. Ryan Harris, how you doing?
Doing great, man. It's been a fun week. I can't believe it, really. It's a little surreal.
Yeah, let's start there. We're catching you hours, like mere hours after your first title in Memphis. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
You know, I got a question for you. When you won on Sunday, over Twitter, people were saying, well, you know, take Ryan Harrison off the board. He's won his first title now. How conscious are you and how conscious of players to the fact that they may or may not have won a career title? I mean, how big a milestone is this for you?
Well, I mean, obviously it's something I've wanted to achieve my whole career, but having never made a final, I didn't really have the, you know, I haven't won one sort of jitters or mental block. Actually, that mental block was more for me in the semifinals because I'd lost in seven consecutive semifinals or something like that. So once I got through the semis, that sort of pressure was off, but there was the whole pressure about playing in your first final and wanting to win after that.
It felt different? You were nervous going out there even after the semis?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was, I don't know, 10 or 12 times before the match that you start thinking about it and kind of playing it out in your head and then starting to think, what if I win? And all the people that you know will be following and watching and supporting. And you get a little emotional starting to think about it and how awesome it would be and how much you want it. But then you start trying to get back in the moment and get back in your preparation because certainly won't happen if you're not ready to play.
Do you know the players out there that have and haven't won titles? I mean, if I give you a name, do you know, oh, yeah, he won Mets in 2013?
I mean, about knowing most of it. I mean, I think that there's one player who's probably the most historic player and one of the best players who's never won a title that people know about. But I know that there's a few guys who are really good players that haven't won titles before.
Is he French?
He's French and got a great backhand.
I'll be the bad guy. We're talking about Julian Bento, right?
Yeah, he's made quite a few finals, too. I mean, rather than it being a kind of a knock on him not winning a title, I think it's a testament to how great the rest of his career has been because he's truly a fantastic player.
Yeah, that's a good point. People were saying to me, I said, well, who's the best player not to have won a title now? And people were saying, like, oh, it's Taylor Fritz. And I'm like, Taylor Fritz? He's like a teenager. And then you realize that it's probably as much a function of how highly people regard you as a player than anything about your shortcomings. But
the tennis world is kind of always what's happened lately sort of atmosphere. So I'm sure people remember how well Fritz has been playing over the last little while. But Beneteau being in his 30s now and having an amazing career for most of the last decade, I would put him in the top category there.
Did you learn that the hard way?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, I talked about it a little bit post-match, but, you know, when you come on the scene early like I did and, you know, some of these guys like Taylor and Francis and Riley and Michael Moe and a lot of these guys, Jared Donaldson, have, you know, you're always going to reach some sort of plateau at some point in time, whether that happens when you're 100 or 70 or 50. It's just hard to be on a, you know, one-way straight path up. You're going to have some sort of setbacks. But for me, I just didn't handle a setback as well as I could have. It took me a little longer to figure out, but I guess that's why I'm fortunate I got a good jump on it, because now I'm still 24 and have some room to work up.
We keep saying this. There was an announcement today that Federer had committed to Basel today through 2019. So when you can play into your deep into your 30s, you know, you're probably less upset when you're 21, 22 and you hit those rough patches. What do you mean when you say you didn't handle as well as you could have?
You know, for me, when I hit that first plateau, and every point in my career had always been going up from, you know, the junior days when you're getting older and bigger and faster and stronger, you're always improving. And then you start the professional tour on the Futures and Challengers, and you kind of work your way up each sort of step along the way. And then, you know, when everything's new, you're not feeling a whole lot of pressure because you're just kind of swinging out and playing your game and not really dealing with so much pressure on yourself, really, because everything's just looking up. But when I hit that first sort of setback, when I got to 40 in the world, and then the previous summer where I had played into, I guess, the semifinals and a couple later rounds in the U.S. Open Series, and then my ranking went from 45 or so on down to 60 and then 80. Rather than just a calming sort of keep working feeling around me, I had some panic, and that sort of led to a lack of emotional control and all of that sort of pressure and that expectation that I was putting on myself was one of the things that led to me not being able to control my emotions out there. I don't think it was ever a talent thing. I think that I have the ability to keep moving forward and to keep going on up from here. So the emotional side of things was definitely what led to the way that things played out for a while.
I was going to ease into this, but you went there, so let's stay there. Give us a sense. I mean, one of the reasons that I've always enjoyed talking to you is you have a real sort of analytical, rational approach to tennis. I mean, I don't you sit there on Tennis Channel or in the interview, you don't come across as an emotional guy. You come across as a thoughtful guy who's really given a lot of time and attention to this. It's four all in the third set. I mean, what is the conversation you're having in your head when you're not buoyant with confidence?
Well, when you're not confident, you're thinking about all the negative things. What's the implications of losing? I don't want to miss this forehand. I really hope I make a first serve. All the things like that go through your head. And then whenever you're in a rut, and it's really been a lot of negative matches in a row, then you kind of do the here we go again sort of thing, where you think that you're, you know, even though you're tied in the score, it feels like you're at a 20% chance to win the match because of how many, you know, lack of successful attempts you've had in recent months or recent years. But as things kind of turned around, you know, those thoughts start turning into more positive thoughts. Okay, I'm down 15-40 here, but I can hit a big serve here. You know, if I go here, I should get this response, and then I'll be playing aggressively with my forehand. And you start to think proactively and in a positive train of thought.
Is there a way to turn that around inorganically? I mean, the obvious solution is win matches, right? But
Win matches. But you know, for me, I had to hit rock bottom and just kind of decide if I even wanted to continue playing in 2016. After Wimbledon, I was telling everybody around me that I needed a break. It had been too many years and too many matches and tournaments in a row where it wasn't just that I was losing; it was just that I was coming off the court after losing and feeling like I hadn't gotten any better with each match and tournament. I wasn't getting closer to my dreams. If anything, I was getting farther away. And the negative feeling was so overwhelming that I felt like, you know, I was underachieving every time I stepped on the court. That's not a good feeling. For as much as I love tennis, for as much as you love anything, if you feel like you're kind of failing day in and day out, it's hard, you know, especially when you have a persistent mindset like mine and you just tell yourself for the better part of 3 years that it's going to continue to turn around if you stay aggressive or stay disciplined with your work ethic. But for me, I couldn't change my mind in the way that I was thinking out there, and that never allowed me to free up.
I can imagine your success this year? I mean, just to level set, you started outside the top 100. Now you're at 43, and you're not defending much. I mean, imagine your success this year is all the more gratifying given where you've been.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's kind of why it's been so special and why I was so overwhelmed with emotions. Just to think that I've turned it around and kind of gotten things going the way it's been going the last 6 or 7 months has been so special. I'm so appreciative for all the people around me who kind of gave me that little push and always have given me that sort of confidence, even when I didn't really see it myself. I remember joking around last summer after I lost at Wimbledon going, all right, well, when does football season start? I've always been able to throw a good football. Maybe they'll let me play at college somewhere. But in a half joking way, you know, you don't really want to ever be saying that sort of thing as a professional athlete, because kind of means you've lost a little bit of belief in yourself. And when I was saying that to family and friends, I had so many people around me who were quickly able to snap me back into the persistent, resilient mindset that's always been my MO. So I'm just really lucky to have those people around me.
I don't know if it's the lack of a guaranteed contract or the fact that, you know, everybody but one person is leaving a tournament on a losing streak, but I feel like you don't have that in other sports. I don't think there are a lot of baseball players that go through a slump and they may be upset and they may be looking to change their routine, but I don't think too many of them are saying, boy, I wonder if being an electrician wasn't the way to go. I mean, I don't think you have these existential issues in too many other sports.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, as well as I did at a young age, I was fortunate to make some money early on in my career. But then whenever you spend 3 years playing predominantly at the challenger level and you're still trying to make the commitment from a coaching and training standpoint of someone who's on the tour, which means I'm paying out a couple hundred thousand dollars in salaries to staff and coaches and training and therapy every year, well, I find myself for 3 years losing a couple hundred thousand dollars. Now, that doesn't happen to everybody on the Challenger Tour because not everybody travels with a coach every week or a physio and that sort of thing. But, you know, I was looking at where I was and seeing a lot of the money that I'd made early on in my career start to slip away. And then you start to make decisions and wonder, you know, do I need to cut back with what I'm spending? But then you're running the risk of not being as professional because you don't have that sort of daily commitment of people who are on you. And that's when a lot of the self-doubt starts to creep in because you don't really know where you're at or where you can be and what the future holds.
Where are you with your staffing? One reason I ask you that is because according to Wikipedia, you're currently being coached by Brad Gilbert but Jay Berger. But I mean, I think that's a really interesting point, that on the one hand, you may want to cut some corners, but at the same time, it's your career. You don't want to go out there with, you know, feeling as though you didn't do everything in your power to win and succeed. But where are you with staffing?
That's a big struggle.
This balance, you mean, between do I really need to fly first class and have a physio with me?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of guys, especially on the Challenger circuit, deal with that sort of thing because – you don't know how much you're going to make each week because the first round prize money is like $800.
Right.
But if you lose first round and you spent a grand to get there, well, you're in the red. So that's not a good feeling, especially as you start to pile on coaches' fees and coaches' hotels and all of those things. But you know that when you're at the Challengers and you're trying to develop into becoming a tour player, but all the tour players already have that sort of day-in, day-out commitment, it's especially hard because you're dealing with yourself playing a lesser level and having less resources. And that's where it makes it tough. But for my personal situation, you know, my dad's always been someone who's been involved. Frankly speaking, in recent years, I guess in the last year or so, we've started to been able to figure out the dynamic in which he can best help me because
right.
There was times where his personality being almost identical to mine, even though we both had the best intentions, we weren't able to cooperatively work together. So the recent years have seen us start to develop into figuring it out more, and the last 7 or 8 months have really been as good as it could have gone. I've got Peter Lukasin, who's part-time with the USTA, who helps me out on the traveling side. Peter doesn't do every single week, so we also hired David Sanguinetti, who is a former player and someone who can kind of bring a lot of experience to the team and be involved as much as possible. But, you know, my dad is not someone who travels full-time. He travels with my brother when my brother's playing, and I get to see him a little bit, but not every week. So my traveling team consists of David and Peter.
Gotcha. And we should add, your dad has a background in tennis and played at a high level, and I think he had some points, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he played on the ATP Tour. You know, he could have, I'm sure he should have gotten a lot higher than his ranking reflects, because he didn't really have the luxury of a whole lot of financial support after college. So he played some satellites and things like that. But he's he's always been a high performance coach. He works at IMG Bolitaris. He works with the top group of guys and girls there. He works a lot with Heather Watson.
Yeah.
He coaches Madison Bringle. Bringle had that huge win over Serena in Auckland, and she was there alone. But the person who was putting the day in and day out work with her in the off season was my dad, you know, feeding her balls every day. So he's definitely behind the scenes worked with tons of players, and numerous different players who have gone through the academy have always talked and spoken so highly of my dad. So that's not just me. I mean, I can tell you all the things he's done for me, but everybody knows that he's always been willing to give and give and give to anybody really who comes through there.
I love this line. I got to find it real quick, but I love a line on your dad that at one point was on your bio that at age 11, Ryan entered the Shreveport City Championships and reached the final, where he lost to his dad.
Yeah, it was
details.
He put a beat down on me.
I was gonna say he's got an 11-year-old son on the other side of the net, and he's remember the score?
6-1, 6-3, something like that.
Okay. He gave you a couple games.
He put a beating on me pretty good.
There's a lesson to be learned, son.
Yeah, well, he was not gonna let me win that in front of hundreds of people. You know, it would have been nice to have me win that match, but I know that for him, having me reach the finals and lose to him was about as good as it could have gone.
No, I was just thinking the Shreveport's that's not terribly far from Memphis. Did you have a big crew there?
Yeah, big crew came up. We had probably 20 or 30 family and close friends that drove in. It meant a lot to have them there, because these were the people who saw me at 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, out there putting in the work that probably looked a little bit insane from a 9-year-old at that time. But it all has kind of worked into who I am today. But I'm fortunate, because I've always been someone who loves tennis. So spending a lot of time on the court was never stressful. You know, it's always been really, really fun, especially at a young age. I would say the most stressful time were probably those years where I had setbacks, but certainly at a young age, you never had to drag me to the courts. I was always ready to go.
Can we go back to the on-court emotion? Because I think anyone that's listened this far and hears you, again, talk thoughtfully and rationally, might have a hard time reconciling that with some of the emotion on the court, right? So even this is going to sound harsher than I mean it to, but the quick Google search: Ryan Harrison throws racket into tree. Ryan Harrison tells father to leave. That is not the person I'm talking to. And we talked about this with Murray yelling at his box, and we've talked about it years ago with Andy Roddick. I mean, can you kind of take us through what goes on from an emotional standpoint where you're maybe emoting on a court in a way that's totally at odds, at variance with how you are when you're sitting down and talking to me by phone? I mean, what's going on?
I'm getting better at that. I mean, I think that most people who are adults can look back at the time that they were 20, 21, 22 and really hope that none of the cameras were around to film them every time they were, you know, doing this, that, and the other. So for me, just the spotlight was there whenever I was making some mistakes in life that everyone had made. I think that anyone can look back at those years of their life and said, wow, if there had been a camera on at that moment, I probably wouldn't have got the best representation of who I feel like I am as a person. And then the instance with my dad, you know, it's not coming from us resenting each other or anything. We just both have a really fiery personality where we both, it killed us both to have me not playing the level that I was. And so with us both being proactive, fiery type people, and not having a clear-cut plan with each other to figure out how we were going to get there, sometimes in the middle of matches, we would be at odds on the way to fix it, and that would be magnified when cameras are on.
Right.
So things could get a little tough and tricky in those moments. But as I've gotten older, you know, you start to understand how you want to go about the process of getting to where you want to go. Like I talked about before, turning it around from rock bottom, you have an appreciation for those who are really always there for you. And now, you know, all those emotions coming together at the end of Memphis, you know, if you spend your entire life dreaming of something and then you feel like it's within reach and then it's all of a sudden not, whenever it finally feels like it is again, it's a really overwhelming moment.
You want to hear my theory on this?
Yes, sir.
Tell me what you think of this. That when all of us are in these states of arousal, I don't mean sexual arousal, but it could be anger. It could be a guy cutting us off in traffic. You know, when you're in competition and it's a one-on-one sport, you have this like turbo level of arousal, and that really changes our decision-making processes. And that most of us can't imagine. I mean, we get cut off, or our kids get tripped in a soccer game, and we're ready to fight the guy. What tennis players go through in an individual sport is that to an exponential level.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no hiding either, because you're out there the entire time with the camera on you. You know, if a baseball player strikes out, he can go into the dugout and destroy the water jug. You know, if a football player throws an interception, he can walk over there and have a moment where nobody's really looking at him. He can kind of blow off some steam. And with tennis, everything you do or say, I mean, you can't even lip or mouth any bad word now without the camera picking it up. It's truly a different sort of sport in that sense. But, you know, that's what makes it so hard to get to the top and stay at the top, because it's really, really a tough road.
Tell me about your match preparation. That obviously you've got a day in between at Slams, at Memphis. You didn't have that luxury much. You walk off the court, you win your match, you get a court time, you're going to be playing the third on tomorrow, or you're playing the first night session tomorrow. What goes on in that 18-hour interval? What are you doing from one round to the next?
Well, the first thing you do is you take care of your body from the previous, you know, round that you just played. You have to make sure that your body's recovered. So I personally like to stretch in a hot tub if it's available, just because I stiffen up pretty quickly. So when I get in the hot tub, it loosens me up. So I usually bring in two or three waters or Gatorades, and then I get in the hot tub and I kind of relax and I stretch out in there for a while, because just makes me feel like maybe I'm a little more limber than I would be if I wasn't in there. And then after that, I jump in the shower, I grab some food, and then I go straight to the training room, where usually they do some work on my shoulder or low back, because those are kind of a couple other areas of hot spots whenever you're playing a lot of matches. So after that, rest is extremely important. You have to make sure you get enough sleep. If you're playing a night match, it's nice to get a nap in the next day. And on the court, you know, it needs to be short but intense. It has to be something that gets you sweating and gets you going for me, but not something that is going to exhaust you.
What do you mean by that? You're talking about the matches, the sort of pre-match, just to hit?
As far as like the warm-up and
right,
the hitting. You know, if you warm up for the match rather than hitting for an hour or something like that, I usually hit from 20 to 30 minutes to get warmed up, but it's pretty physical.
I was at IMG maybe, I guess it was late 2015, and got to meet your brother and spend some time with him. He was playing with Michael Moe that day. Lovely guy. How's he doing, and what is the dynamic of, we talked about this with the Zverev brothers, and obviously Venus and Serena are the standard bearers, but what's it like to have a sibling in the same line of work?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, Christian's someone who is a hard worker. He's been through a lot of setbacks with numerous injuries, but for him to qualify at the U.S. Open this year was incredible. I mean, I don't think anyone was expecting that to happen, and he might have even surprised himself a little bit. And after all the emotions that he's been through trying to figure out if he was ever going to get to play again, just from a health standpoint, for him to qualify for a slam, I'm sure it felt like he won it at the time. But for him now, it's a matter of trying to maintain a consistency. You know, every tournament that you play is not a grand slam, and you want to have a consistent sort of level week in and week out, and that also requires good health. He's been trying to find the balance of therapy and how much to play and how much to practice, and You know, I don't think he's 100% there yet with knowing exactly how much his body can take and how much he can play without his body feeling a little overworked. Slowly he's getting there. You know, he's getting older and more mature and starting to realize what the best recipe is for himself. But I think that we're lucky to have each other in the sport. We can support each other in tough times. And, you know, he's always been someone who's been very supportive of me, and I'd do absolutely anything for him too.
Your sister plays as well?
Sister plays at Mississippi State University.
She's
a junior, and I can't believe she's a junior. It's crazy for me to say, but we've got a whole tennis family. She was one super tiebreaker away from being an All-American last year, which sadly didn't go her way, but she's got a good chance, and hopefully we'll pull that off this year.
And she gets to go to college.
She's
telling someone. That's good living. Everything personal life, everything else good with you?
Yeah, everything's great. Lauren just ran over to grab us some breakfast right around the corner at Einstein's Bagels. So she's bringing us some breakfast. We're packing up and getting ready to go to Acapulco tonight. You know, obviously the wedding's coming up, and I'm so happy and so lucky to be marrying her. She's a great girl, and I love her to death. And, you know, the support's been there throughout. You know, we've been dating for 4 years, and like we've talked about, a lot of the 4 years haven't been up points of my career, but I can honestly say that I never reached a point of, like, truly life depression. You know, I've been able to have that love and support around me my whole career, and it starts with her and with my family and friends. You know, I've been able to enjoy my life despite some of the setbacks that have happened on the tennis court.
I'll give you another point in favor of your fiance. She's a very nice writer. She's a great writer.
She is. She's a journalism major at UNC and does a great job. She's currently been writing out all of our thank you cards for the wedding gifts that have been coming in. So I get to see it every day right now. And I don't know if she wants me to help. My lack of college education might not be quite up to par with her journalism major.
Let her take care of that. Have you figured out sort of how that's going to work in terms of travel?
Well, she's very fortunate to have a job that allows her to travel and still work. It probably amounts to 3 or 4 months a year that she ends up working. You know, Channel 7, the Australian network that covered the Australian Open every year 3 or 4 years ago, hired her as a production assistant. And, you know, I've known Todd Woodbridge a long time, and I can't thank him enough for what he did for our soon-to-be family and marriage, because the job opportunity that he gave her and got her with Channel 7 allowed her to work on the road while also being at tournaments that I was playing. So our relationship dynamic was able to play out where, you know, she wasn't just traveling, reading a book all day while I was practicing. She has 3 or 4 months a year where she works and does sort of production stuff in TV networks. And then she's picked up some, you know, other freelance jobs that are on the road. But she only works on the road right now. She has some gigs in Austin that will work if there's an event going on here. She worked the X Games or some random baseball games here, but most of the time it's on the road traveling where we're at.
Austin is your Austin's the base, though?
Austin's the base, yeah, Austin's home.
Do you agree with me that Torchy's Tacos is superior to any barbecue in town?
Torchy's Tacos is amazing. We were talking about Torchy's this morning, actually, but we're hopefully going to try and stay healthy.
I'm telling you, that's not just like a touristy thing for people like me. Like, people in Austin recognize how good that place is, right?
I'm pretty sure we have Torchy's in our trash can right now from breakfast yesterday morning, so I think it's in there.
Enough said. You're off to Acapulco, and then just picking it back up, and you'll be in the desert, and you'll be in Miami, and these are just kind of the rhythms of your life now?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's a lot of fun. I mean, when you're playing well, it doesn't feel like traveling is stressful anymore. You're just kind of getting there and going week to week and hoping it continues. And, you know, like I talked about a little bit earlier, I'm not putting a whole lot of pressure on myself now, and especially after winning the title, I don't want to raise this crazy expectation. My goal for the year is the same as it's been since I started the year, which is basically I wanted to play every single week this year, whether it was 25 weeks of tournaments or 26 or however many ended up being. And I wanted to feel like every single week that I left it all out there and got better. that's my goal. Results are going to kind of come and go, so I'm hoping that they keep coming. But either way, I'll be improving.
I got two more for you. You know what always interests me about these conversations is that they don't really go to accuracy and power hitting the ball, right? It's not about statistics. It's not about raising my – I mean, this sounds like this conversation and others I've had with other players. They're so much about self-realization and confidence and rhythm and vibe and optimism. It doesn't really come down to a conversation about hitting spots with serves and working on break games won and backhand returns. Do you see tennis analytically as well? I mean, are you looking at match seats, or are you saying, listen, I wish I could add two more miles to my wide serve to the deuce court? Or is this really stay in the realm of I just need to stay positive and stay confident?
It just depends on where you're at.
Did that make sense, by the way? Did that question make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I understand what you're saying. I mean, you have to figure out if it's mentally or physically what's kind of holding you back at the time. For me, it's been more mental than physical. There has been some things over my game that I have to continue to work on, but work ethic has never been a problem. You know, my biggest problem, I guess, the average person can relate to it as far as when you're playing golf and you get on a tee box and you really want to pipe a drive, as soon as you tighten up and try to rip it, you got no chance of controlling it.
Right,
and that sort
right.
of tightness and feeling was what I was playing with. And as everyone who has ever tried to really, really swing a hard golf club knows, whenever you're not relaxed, you're not going to be near as controlled or able to get easy power. And if you imagine me out there playing with that sort of tenseness every day, day in and day out, that's where my ability wasn't reflective at the time of what I felt like I was capable of.
All right, last question. We've gone this far. Sean Payton played out?
Sean Payton is a great coach. I'm very happy with Sean Payton. I hope we can keep him. He's been a fantastic person for New Orleans and the community and the Saints. We're lucky to have him and Drew Brees as the leaders of our team. And I'm inspirational and optimistic about the next upcoming season. I felt like we lost a lot of close games this year. Couple things that we could have cleaned up on special teams, but I know that they're working hard to get that done. I'm looking forward to a Super Bowl run. And I just got to say that John Isner's Panthers were pretty awful, and even though they made the finals.
That was like 1 year of lightning in a bottle, and then it was back to the old Panthers.
Exactly.
This was great. Go get on a plane. Go win some more matches, but it's always a pleasure, and happy we were able to do this. Let's do it again.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, man. Hope to see you guys soon.
Tell that fiance to keep writing.
I will.
All right, good luck. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, that does it for this week. Good talk. That was Ryan Harrison. Really enjoyed that. Always a pleasure talking to him, and appreciate the candor. We would expect nothing less from a Texan. That was Ryan Harrison. I'm John Wertheim. The producer, as always, is Jamie Lasanti. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Feel free to keep the suggestions coming. I'm on the road next week, but we'll try to do one of these in advance, and then we'll be in the desert in Indian Wells. So thanks for listening. That's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Ryan Harrison was a terrific guest. We'll do another one in 7 days. Have a good week.